The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I think they want you all to sit around the little microphone. Our plan during this last session we've got together is to wrestle through, as we said last week, some of the creeds. There were three creeds that you were asked to read in the course. One was this creed, Our World Belongs to God, which was produced by the Christian Reformed Church in the United States. And then the creed produced by the Reformed Church in Japan. And then a third produced by the Dutch Reformed Mission Church of South Africa. What we want to do this time is to sort of think through those things. Just to get you started in terms of an idea. Are you leaving, Garnett? Okay. I think this sort of sets it up and may give you an idea what we're talking about. I've got a tract here that was produced by the Jews for Jesus. I want you to listen to it. I don't have enough copies to give to you because I think it's the visual thing that's also very significant in this. But the tract is called Jesus Made Me Kosher. Have any of you seen this tract before? Yeah, Will, it runs about, it's one of these kinds of things, one of these fold-up things. I think it sort of highlights some of the struggles that we want to go through in terms of evaluating communication of the gospel. It's written in first person singular, and it's written, as it were, putting it in the hands of somebody who's a North American Jew. This is how it goes. I was born a Jew, and I'll die a Jew. That's what I heard, and that's what I said. But to me, the Jewish thing was simply Saturday instead of Sunday, Pesach instead of Easter, the Shema instead of Our Father, circumcision instead of baptism. Always something instead of the Jesus thing. Nobody understands our religion very much, not even us. Little picture of a man speaking to his rabbi. Rabbi, what's a Jew? The rabbi says, oi, don't ask. But there's one thing we Jews all know. We've got to keep our own religion. We've got to stick together. Some people see Judaism as a kind of Christless Christianity, even many Jews. Here's a mother's cooking at the stove cartoon, and her son's going out. She says, remember, Moshe, love thy neighbor. Why, Ma? Don't ask. To me, Judaism was really pretty much the same as Christianity, only without Jesus. The Christianity minus Christ equals Judaism. Judaism plus Christ equals Christianity. Zero plus zero equals zero. Because the one thing that I and all my Jewish friends could say for certain was that the Jesus thing was not a Jewish thing, though much more than that we couldn't agree upon. But I have found that there is more than non-Jesusness that makes a Jew a Jew. It was the day I found out that believing in Jesus was indeed the Jewish thing. He is our Messiah, Messiah, and our Kapora, our covering or atonement. He is the one whom the prophet spoke about when he said, and then he quotes Isaiah 53, verse 5. And then in parenthesis, and that was written by a very Jewish prophet. Jesus is what makes some of us want to be more Jewish. Ever wonder what more Jewish could mean? We believe more than ever in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in the survival of the Jewish people, and in the divine establishment of the state of Israel. The words of the Jewish prophets have helped us to believe in Jesus. Read and see for yourself. God never says, don't ask. Jesus might make you kosher, that is, if you want to be. That's the tract. Then is the cartoons. I'll just pass it around. That's very similar to the kind of broadsides that the Jews for Jesus use. Broadside is a specific sort of term that's used to describe kind of homemade tracts. And they're put on broad sheets of paper so that they're, you know, they're not neatly printed kinds of things. They're often sort of runoff, cartoonish style, wild writing, a la this kind of tract, and then distributed on the streets. What hits you as you listen to a tract like that? Comes across very strong in the tract, doesn't it? Just the very title, Jesus Made Me Kosher. Do you sense any kind of, any other impressions along these same lines? He does it with a joke about his mother, you know, saying, "Hey, Moshe, when you go outside, love your neighbor." And then he asks why, and Mom says, "Don't ask." What's interesting to me is in those sections where he deals, like that one, with the places that are missing, you know, the holes that are missing. Notice the way he handles that kind of stuff. He doesn't deal with it in kind of a polemic, blasting kind of way. He deals with it in terms of a joke. He deals with it in a very lighthearted way so that you don't feel there's any kind of put down in terms of how he's saying it. He doesn't pick it up and use it to the advantage of Christianity by saying, "Ha ha, I told you so," that kind of thing. So even when he touches on it, he's just, even the way that he touches on it is very gracious and funnish. One of the things that's, I think, exciting about something like this is that here's an effort that's been made to respond to a need within the community. One of the virtues of a tract like this is it's beautifully receptor-oriented. Evangelical tracts, by and large, I think, tend to assume a reader that lived 100 years ago. So most of the tracts, particularly the ones that are produced at the rate of 800,000 an hour, somewhere in somebody's basement in Grand Rapids, those kinds of tracts usually assume that the person who's going to pick it up is somehow or other knows an awful lot about Christian theology and just needs kind of a reminder. So the focus then goes on faith and repentance. And the language of the tract and of the literature comes out of the 19th century and assumes kind of a 19th century general background. This tract makes no kinds of assumptions like that. Is he playing well on the fact that they don't know, or the fact that they sort of do know but they can't give you the right answer, or they can't give you a single answer as to what makes them Jewish? So at the beginning there's that little cartoon when the fella asks the rabbi, "Rabbi, what makes a Jew?" And he says, "Oh, you don't ask." So that there's certain assumptions they've got, but there's such diversities of answers, you know, they can't pin it down. It's a little different than sort of going at emptiness. I sense what he's working on is he's working on a deep sensitivity to the fact that no matter what that Jew, how that Jew looks at himself, herself, that person knows I am a Jew. But there will be umpteen distinctions as to how they can define that. About a year or two ago, there was an article in Time magazine, a cover article on what makes a Jew. And you read through the article, and you're struck by the fact that that Jewishness as an ethnic character, as a quality, is very tough to define. On the one hand, you go up to New York City and you go to the Queens and the Bronx, and you drive through on a Saturday morning the Sephardic community, and you've got all the kids with the long locks and the black coats, and you know that definition of Jewishness is deeply religious. But then that Saturday night you go to a play, which may be written by a Jewish writer who's an atheist. And yet at the same time that play has its unique Jewish quality, and yet has nothing to do with even faith in God, and yet its characteristics and its focus is still Jewish. So on the one, you've got sort of a continuum here, and on the one hand you've got a Jewishness which is kind of religious in its orientation, And then on the other hand, you've got atheistic Jewishness too. Now, how can you have both and still be Jewish? I think that's part what he's trying to deal with in this thing, that he's wrestling with the fact that, hey, people nowadays do not define their relationship to Judaism strictly in terms of how they read the Old Testament and what they say about Jesus. They'll define their Jewishness in terms of the festivals they celebrate in their home. They'll define it in terms of, very often, of just the cultural trappings. So it's defined then, and they define themselves in terms of more of their ethnicity than that of their attitude towards God or the Quran or the Torah. Even brouhaha that was occurred recently with the Ethiopian Jews and the difficulties the Ethiopian Jews had in assimilating to life in Israel, and then the criticism that they were facing about not really being Jewish, and their answer was, "We've been Jewish longer than you have." And then, as it were, define again what they're doing is questioning the standards by which you define Jewishness. But all of this, I think, just underlines the fact that don't always simply define Jewishness in terms of what their attitude is towards the Messiah. Because, as a matter of fact, the Messiah to them may be a totally a distant notion. One of my next-door neighbors is a professor of urban studies at Temple University, and I was talking to him across the back fence this weekend, and Cy defines his Jewishness in terms of his activity and his strong participation in the Holocaust studies at university. The furor that's going on right now in the political world about Reagan's visit to a German cemetery where members of the SS are buried, I think has a lot of implications in terms of defining this very thing. There are many people who theologically and in terms of any kind of religious commitment do not define themselves as Jewish, but they will define themselves as Jewish in terms of that event, which is deeply, deeply significant for the Jews of the last four decades, and that is in terms of the Holocaust. I'm trying to think in terms of an exact parallel. I find myself wondering if somewhat close to it, at least in this area, is the Muslim community. In terms of defining Muslims, a Muslim will tell you that to constitute their Muslims generally reject the idea that's often characteristic of Christians in terms of talking about good Christians and bad ones, strong Christians and carnal Christians. For the Muslim, there are no such categories. For the Muslim, there is only a Muslim. Now, what constitutes a Muslim? When it boils right down to it, what constitutes a Muslim is his or her honest confession of the creed or the Sharia. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. When a Muslim baby is born, the mother reaches over, and the first words the baby hears are breathed into its ear by its mother or father, "There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet." And according to Muslim tradition, the last words that a Muslim utters on the deathbed is that same confession. "There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet." But what is fascinating is to find nowadays, at least in some brands of Islam, a wide divergency. So, for example, I remember a trip to India in 1974, and I was traveling with seven seminary students. We're on the plane, a 24-hour flight to India, and sitting across the aisle from me were two Muslims. And we got talking. They were drunk by the time the plane arrived in Delhi. They had piles of pornographic literature, which they were paging through as they read on the plane. And we'd gotten to be fairly close in terms of the flight, and I, without trying to push them unnecessarily, I said, "What will you do as Muslims with all of this literature?" And I thought Muslims didn't use alcoholic beverages, and then one of the fellows said, "Well, we won't when we get home." But they were defining themselves culturally as Muslims. The Black Muslim movement in the United States before 1975, in a real sense, I think, was more of a culture definition. Fred, Brother Jerkins here, is working on that movement now. But my own experience is that what really put the Muslim movement together in the United States was its strong anti-racist ideas. And along with that, its very anti-white categories. In 1975, when Elijah Muhammad died and his son, Wallace Dean Muhammad, ascended and became the imam of the American Muslim movement in the United States, the American Muslim mission, a shift took place. And within black Muslims, it moved from this sort of anti-racist end of the scale more and more over to this end of the scale. So that now the Muslim movement in the United States has been generally accepted as a legitimate part of the tradition of Islam. That's, I think, another place. One of the most interesting, to illustrate this, one of the most interesting practices that's being carried, or discussions being carried on now within the Muslim community, or within the Christian evangelistic community, is how to, pardon me, how to appropriate and make use evangelistically of this kind of sort of non-religious Islam, or to develop patterns in the lifestyle of the church so as to make the Muslim feel culturally as much as home as possible within the life and fellowship of the church. The person who has done that the most is, who's written about that the most, is a Mr. Phil Parshall. And he has not really written much about some of the theological issues involved. Most of his writing and thinking has been involved in terms of changing the structure or strategies of the church. He has a book just published about a year ago by Baker Bookhouse called Bridges to Islam. And probably the more well-known one, if you want to read one, is called New Paths in Muslim Evangelism. Also published by Baker. For a number of years, Phil was a missionary. He's spoken here at Westminster, I think it was here last year, 2 years ago. And he's spoken that he was a missionary in Bangladesh. He and two or three of his fellow co-workers were successful in planting the first congregation made up of converts from Islam in the history of Bangladesh. Small churches, each made up, oh, maybe 70 to 80 believers, but the first such churches in hundreds of years. One of the ways he did it was to minimize his own and the participation of the Western missionaries in the process, and to underline that as much as possible, the lifestyle and the worship of the people of God within that community would look Muslim. So, for example, the buildings in which the Lord's people gathered for worship there have no chairs. When you enter the building, you take off your shoes, which is Muslim practice when you enter when you enter the mosque. Outside of the door of the church building is a bowl with water for ceremonial washing. The Quran prescribes that you cannot worship Allah without washing the neck, the ears, and the arms up to the elbow. They do not require this of Christians, but the bowl is there for those who wish to do it. And there are apparently a large percentage of the Christians who will engage in that ceremonial washing. Instead of a box or pulpit, there is a small reading stand, sort of shaped like what we would call a camp cot. And on that cot is placed the Bible. So you do not lift the Bible or carry it up. When the Bible is used in worship, it's placed on a stool. Again, very similar to Islamic practice as a attitude of respect to the Quran. When the Bible is read in worship service, it is not read, it is chanted. Again, similar to Muslim practice in the use of the Quran in the mosque, in mosque worship. There is a minimum of singing. Singing is not carried on at all within the Muslim community. There are ritual forms of prayer during the worship service. The ritual is not demanded, but it's voluntary for those who care to do it in that way. If any of you have seen pictures of... thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Will. If you've seen pictures of Muslims praying together, you realize that there are certain standard forms in which everybody prays together, using the same bodily patterns and the same words. That's also carried on during the worship service. Language or vocabulary that's used to present the gospel is language that ordinarily is taken from the Quran. So, for example, the term for Jesus is the term used in the Quran concerning Jesus. He's referred to as Esau. The terms that are used to designate the Old Testament, what to us are the Old Testament prophets and leaders, are terms that are, again, borrowed from the Quran, from the Arabic. The effort is made then, as much as humanly possible, to fit the lifestyle of the Islamic culture as a culture. There is some question, for example, about... of course, there are any number of questions in all this, but these things are being discussed constantly, but as you can well imagine. But what is exciting to me is that this is probably the most... relatively the most recent breakthrough in terms of changing style, etc., and the most exciting effort made to at least try and fit a distinct culture, and to fit it without compromising the character and shape of the gospel. A very exciting approach to the question of contextualization. And very similar, I think, to the Jews for Jesus kind of thing. Now, where it falls down, or at least what hasn't been worked with yet, is that all these efforts are efforts dealing really basically with just questions of worship style, etc. They would be similar to what we call at the beginning of this term. They fit more into the old rubric of indigenization than they really do under contextualization. But in this new book that Parshall has written, Bridges to Islam, he's beginning now to get into that whole area of the actual verbalization of the gospel. But it's still a relatively untouched area, and one will have to wait and see what happens to in the future. But it's one effort to try and touch this area. Let's, as a sample, I think it would be good if maybe some of us could take some time and visit some of the Muslim mosques here in the United States. Go on Fridays at the time of noon prayers, and watch carefully to see what kind of practices go on in those mosques here in the United States. I think you'd find them very similar. The one or two I've been to, where the vast percentage are there are American blacks, take off the shoes, there's a washing, there's a preaching thing which fits with it more than they have at the time of regular prayers. But that makes me ask whether, in order to reach then, American blacks who become Muslims, and you want to bring them back to the gospel, or bring them to the Lord, then maybe what we're going to have are buildings, are situations like that. Now, but I think what's got to happen is we've got to talk to people about that possibility. Anise isn't here this morning, that's too bad, but one of the reasons, Anise's ministry, as you may know, is called Church Without Walls. And one of the reasons that he picked that name, as far as I can understand it, is because he wants to try and break away from this notion that of church as a building, but even more, not necessarily for North American reasons, but simply because he wants to introduce the idea of the church as the people of God, which is the idea it has within Islam. One of the areas where Christians are very often criticized by Muslims is because of their strong attachment, their way of defining church as building. And that happens over and over again. So when Anise calls his ministry Church Without Walls, I think one of the things he's trying to do is to get out of that kind of pattern of understanding church. And he has been talking about trying to do this same kind of thing. But part of the difficulty, I suspect, is that also there have not been as yet enough converts to begin to build a group like that. I'm not sure. I was thinking about this the other day, Fred, and I was thinking, you know, part of the thing is you could have the difficulty would be, so let's say you want to reach this segment of the American black population. They've been tied up with Islam, and now it looks like they may be willing to come out. To get them to come back into, let's say, the old style of black worship may be too difficult for them. Maybe what you need then, what you may find, is you may find that you need two different kinds of churches. Because a lot of the folks who are Christians now and been saved and ministered to by the church for years, those folks are not going to be very happy taking off their shoes and sitting on the floor and going through all this rigmarole in order to win some Muslims. You may lose more Christians in the process. Because, you know, that's their cultural pattern. But why not then have a couple of ways of gathering the Lord's people? So that you pioneer, as it were, not only in terms of the ministry you've got now with the Lord's people and the way that they traditionally worship, but also, hey, you think to yourself, if I'm really going to be serious about reaching these Muslims, I've got to have different patterns where they can worship in a way that fits them. Maybe that's what we need. And could you have ways, too, where could you even do that under one church, as it were? But the Muslims have those special occasions when they worship with patterns that are that are culturally very appropriate for them. But then also there are those times when all these people are going to get together for common worship and praise. And then sometimes on those occasions you're going to use traditional patterns that the Lord's people are used to. On other occasions you're going to use the traditional Muslim patterns, and the Lord's people are going to learn to use those. But you keep the Lord's people together, but at the same time give them distinctive, appropriate ways where they can worship. I think one of the things I would try to do, that visit I mentioned to the mosques, part of the reason behind that visit is to just try and find out how serious these patterns of worship are for those who are there. But the deeper question I think I'd want to ask in terms of going to a place like that and talking to my friends would be to ask people why they became Muslims. What was it that drew them to Islam? And then I would have to work hard at listening very, very carefully, because, you know, we've got our own kind of theological ways in which we hear people. Somebody might say to us, well, what drew me to Islam, and I've heard this before, was I found here that they had really emphasized the family. And we didn't have a family before. And now Islam is emphasizing I've got a responsibility to fulfill as a father and as a husband. And I'm stepping into that role. All right. Sometimes we can put some of that in our own theological categories and don't really hear what they're saying. On the other hand, what we can hear, if we listen carefully, is, hey, is there some way then that Christianity has got to speak up to respond to that kind of felt need? I think part of the trouble is we don't really hear people, and we don't ask those kinds of questions. But I would guess that's one thing that we would have to do. If I were in a neighborhood like mine or anybody else's where there's a heavy percentage of American blacks who become Muslims, I think what I'd want to do is, hey, I want to send out the members of my church to talk to folks. And I send them all over the place. Send them to baseball fields, anywhere they could go. Stop on the street corner and talk to folks. And I would collect from my neighborhood maybe 300-400 answers about why people have become Muslims or why they don't go to church. And then when I was done with that, I would start figuring out what were the great block of reasons. And I might come away with about 5 or 6 major reasons why most of the people in my neighborhood became Muslims. And then I would look down over those reasons and I'd say, okay, what is there in these reasons that we have been neglecting as a Christian church? Or what are some of the things that we need to underline in order to reach these same people? And then I'd reach out to do it. I'd change the character of my preaching. I'd work at changing the whole style of the church so that we would aim ourselves at trying to meet those needs. In many of the ethnic churches, not just black Americans, many of the ethnic churches in the United States, why do people go to church? the Korean churches. In Philadelphia, we have now nearly 70 Korean churches. They have grown very, very fast. Large influx of Korean people. Now, there's a strong percentage, of course, of Christians among those. But by and large, what you will very often hear from a new Korean is that who is just coming into the neighborhood is that they will go to the Korean church because very often the Korean church is a place where they can meet other Koreans. They just come into Philadelphia. They don't know anybody around. Maybe they have a family here, a small family, but they have to make contacts. They have to get out into the neighborhood and get out in the Korean neighborhood to build links. Well, where do they go to meet other Koreans? Well, there's the place where, by and large, they can find other Koreans the quickest and easiest is the Korean church. And so very often, Korean pastors in neighborhoods like this will take advantage of that. They'll find out when the Korean immigrants move in, and then immediately go to them, welcome them to the neighborhood, and very often try to act as kind of help in terms of meeting local needs, getting into the community, getting situated, establishing relationships. All right, what they're doing is meeting felt needs of that community, but not on this end, more on the cultural end. And then through that cultural attachment, the gospel is heard and preached. I think that very often happens. And the cultural differences are strong ones. One other sample I'll give you in this area, I think. And that's the difference, and Aaron can help us, but the difference between within the Chinese culture in the United States, between the so-called American-born Chinese, ABCs, and the Chinese-born, what are they called now?
OBCs,
overseas-born Chinese. And so you will find within a Chinese community churches that are made up of different kinds of Chinese. And they're not divided according to the language that they speak, whether it's Mandarin or Cantonese or Fukienese. They're often divided in terms of where they come from. And who sort of owns this church. Is this church controlled, directed by American-born Chinese, or isn't it? And the conflicts then that take place in the Chinese churches, Korean churches, between the first generation and the second, third generations, as they divide and divide again, so you can have in one congregation almost virtually several congregations. The obligations then that the pastor has to try and reach those several cultural groups that all exist under that one category or name. That's part of the struggle. I think that's trying to achieve the balance is where it's really tough. Let me try a couple of things on you to reinforce what I said. Ordinarily, I think Dr. Donald McGavran has said it many times. His is the name you've heard most often, I think, around here. And that is that ordinarily people like to become Christians without crossing ethnic or cultural or linguistic or sociological barriers. Is that right or wrong? Yes, I think that's right. That is without a doubt correct. Well, I don't think what McGavran is arguing is that in all cases people don't decide whether they're going to visit this church or attach themselves to that group because that group happens to be such and such a group. I don't think he's arguing for that. But what he's arguing for is that whether overtly or covertly, that is just simply the way people come to Christ. That to my mind historically is indisputable. For example, if you visit the churches of Philadelphia, go into my neighborhood with Germantown area with over 30 churches, actually I think closer to 60. If you visit all of those churches, more than likely you will find two or at the most maybe three that are, quote, integrated. Otherwise, you will step into a worship service, which is probably virtually all black, with maybe one or two whites. Or you'll walk into a white service, which may have one or two blacks. Or you'll walk into a Korean service, which has 100% Koreans. Or maybe one or two Americans who've been invited to teach the Sunday school class to the English-speaking children. I think that's a universal pattern. Or you may find, for example, in my neighborhood, a church like Summit Presbyterian Church, which is made up largely of, which is a roughly about a 50-50 split between blacks and whites. But you will find there, as you look carefully, that what the significant area of homogeneity in that congregation is the fact that many, many of the members of that church are so-called mixed marriages, where one of the partners is black and the other one is white. And they found a church where that homogeneity draws them together. So the homogeneity can be of different sorts. It can be sociological, it can be ethnic, etc. But I think that is universally true across the boards. I don't think can be refuted. I would even say, go so far as to say, I think there's clear evidence for that in the New Testament. A very history of the early church recorded in the book of Acts, draws on those elements of homogeneity. Jews drawn to Jews, Gentiles drawn to Gentiles. The conflict is behind the background of Acts chapter 15 is a conflict over how do we integrate Gentiles into our Jewish church. And the tremendous momentous decisions that were reached there by way of where to go in the future. Now, I think further, that has usually in the past, when we've talked about homogeneity and that kind of way of coming to Christ, we've usually thought of it in numerical terms. And very often when we read people like McGavern, that's how we read McGavern. Well, McGavern's saying if you want to get a really fast church growth going, you stick it in one homogeneous unit, throw in your quarter, pull the lever, and bang, out will come all kinds of people. And I think that's probably quite true. But that isn't simply the kind of level we're talking about. We're talking about growth, not only numerical, but also qualitative growth. I think that's what Barney said, when churches have to struggle with how people worship together. When you put three or four different cultures together into one worship service, there is a discomfort there, and inevitably, whether people are like it or not, one cultural pattern or mold of worshiping has to be chosen. And that cultural pattern or mold will affect the kind of people who come to it. Yesterday, for example, I worshipped in a congregation of the Evangelical Free Church in Princeton, New Jersey. They're meeting in a grade school just outside of Princeton, and I went up. They have a two-hour worship service, and they told me, be sure we get there at 10. Our service is a little different. And one of the pastors there, one of the elders, is a graduate of Westminster Seminary. So for the first 45 minutes, from 10 to about quarter of 11, it was worship. Worship in the sense there was singing. They had three different hymn books. They sang scripture songs. They sang from traditional hymn books. They had guitars. They interspersed the worship with people just spontaneously quoting a Bible verse that meant a lot to them. Somebody else just speaking if they wanted to give a testimony. Somebody else throwing in another Bible verse. Somebody just starting a song. Very spontaneous, sort of flowing kind of worship service. Then, about 10:45, there was a break. And from 10:45 until about 11:15, everybody gathered around the coffee cups. And there was cookies and donuts and cake and other kinds of destroying your body kind of food. And I destroyed mine as well as anybody's. And then one of the pastors asked everybody to sit down. They introduced me, and then I spoke. And then the worship service ended with a benediction and people stayed around to talk. Now, what kind of people would be attracted to that worship service? The children did not meet with the adults. They were taken off separately into different like Sunday school classes during the time of the worship. I would say the average age of the member of that congregation was probably, or the oldest person in that congregation apart from me, was probably in his late 20s. And I would guess the average age, the mean age of that the adults in that congregation would be around 25, 26. And that may be pushing a little bit. The congregation was made up largely of young people. I didn't, any kind of middle-aged people in that congregation. Now, why not? Because the patterns of worship are going to dictate that. Because the choices they have made in how God's people are going to worship are not going to draw middle-aged people or older people who like to hear the organ and who like to have everything out of one hymn book, who like to be told when to get up and when to sit down. Now, there's nothing wrong with any of that. But what that is a worship service being functionally created, structured to meet a certain age and a certain cultural people's expectations. I suspect that what you could do would be go to Princeton, and you could put up a church building of the Evangelical Free Church exactly on the same block across the street from that congregation, and you would have two congregations of the same denomination, and never would they ever cross paths in terms of the people they were trying to reach. They would you'd have churches be growing twice as fast because they're meeting different kinds of needs. Now that's, I think, what McGavern's trying to say. And what he's emphasizing then is as soon as you make choices about the hymn book you use, you are delivering implicitly a sociological message. For example, the very fact that you use a hymn book is saying this is a reading culture. And we're assuming that everybody who comes here to worship has to be able to read and has to have a high proficiency level in reading, particularly if you go to Presbyterian churches where they have what they call responsive readings in the morning service. And you read a psalm, and the pastor will read a verse, and then you've all got to read a verse. Well, what about the poor soul in that congregation who's never finished the seventh grade? Think he's going to go back to that church again? No, he's not. And it isn't the gospel that's driven him away. It's the fact, hey, this church assumes I've got to be able to read like a 12th grader, and I can't do that. So he'll find another church where responsive reading is not a part of that church. I think one of the areas that needs to be appreciated here is something we touched on before. The black culture in the United States, I think, is a richly oral culture. It is not a non-literate culture. It is an oral culture. There's a difference between talking about an oral culture and a non-literate culture. One is a put-down word. An oral culture, it depends on verbalization very strongly. It's not a print-oriented culture. In an oral culture, in the traditions of an oral culture, you've passed on your history by storytelling. Some of you may have read Alex Haley's book, Roots. The roots of the black culture discovered as mother passes it on to mother, and mother passes it on to mother. The roots are oral. The traditions are oral. As a result of that, in that same connection then, when you worship, very often in black churches that are close to those oral traditions, you'll walk into worship service and there's not going to be any hymn books there. The man waiting at the door isn't going to give you an open hymn book to hymn number 422. And there will very likely be no Bibles, or people ordinarily do not easily flip open their Bibles the way they do in a literate culture, let's say 10th Presbyterian Church. There aren't Bibles provided in the pews. Why? Because these folks can't read? No, because this is an oral culture. And that oral culture church is drawing to itself people that 10th Presbyterian Church will never reach in a month of Sundays, and can never reach, because they've made decisions about cultural adaptations that are already excluding certain peoples and aiming for others. So 10th Presbyterian Church attracts yuppies. It's a yuppie church. It attracts young urban professionals. All right, should it develop enough heterogeneity so it attracts the others? It can't. Not in terms of how it's going to structure its worship. Always the element of homogeneity will attract certain kinds of people. How then do you find ways of together expressing, you know, what our brother has said, the unity of the body of Christ? Well, you look for ways where those churches can worship together. You start building networks where the Lord's people together on regular occasions can come together and say before a whole neighborhood, we belong together. That, I think, is where the real tragedy lies in the United States. That's what people like at Cuts at the Center for Urban Theological Studies and others of us are trying to do, to create networks where we can build bridges between the churches of the city and the churches of the suburb, and where on a regular basis the Lord's people can come together for joint worship. That's the great virtue of being Presbyterian. That is, if you want to practice it. You can have, within a regional church, within that regionally connected church, all kinds of places where God's people worship and serve Jesus in all kinds of culturally accepted ways. And yet at the same time, then within that regional body, they can find places and times to come together and say in Philadelphia or Boston or New York or wherever it may happen to be, Jesus has put us together. But the fractionalization, the body of Christ through denominationalism, the racism that sends the white churches off to the suburbs and manages to keep the black churches where they belong, quote unquote, destroys that kind of regional character and balance to the body of Christ. So reconciliation is desperately needed.